The AC Podcast is a ministry of Apologetics Canada and is supported by the generous donations of our listeners. If you would like to partner with us in this ministry, please go to apologeticscanada.com.
Welcome to the AC Podcast. I'm Steve Kim.
Andy Steiger.
Terry Crosby.
And we're coming to you live, almost live, from San Antonio.
Well, more than that. From our hotel room in San Antonio, Texas.
That's right.
And we're on the 19th floor of the Drury Hotel.
Yeah.
You think I pronounced that correctly?
Yep. Drury Plaza Hotel.
It's a fantastic hotel, actually. I'm going to give a shout out to this hotel. Probably one of the best hotels I've ever been in.
Mm-hmm. It was really nice. Nice view and everything. I was actually really pleasantly surprised by San Antonio. The Riverwalk is fantastic. It's gorgeous.
Yeah, it's a
beautiful
city. The
amount of restaurants down there.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, man. Awesome.
Yeah, you can just walk by this river, and it almost feels like you're at a resort or something like that.
Yeah, it's a gorgeous place. We're at the 68th annual Evangelical Theological Society meeting and also the Evangelical Philosophical Society meeting, and we've been having a fantastic week out here. So it's fun to come live now. We still have one more day, but we've already taken in a number of sessions. Been loving it, and it's a great opportunity to get after to speak to on these some of the topics on this podcast.
Yeah, so every year ETS the meeting is held at in a different city, and this year it's in San Antonio, Texas. Now, was there a moment that you thought to yourself, wow, I'm really in Texas? I know for myself, when we were having dinner that first night, we went to this restaurant by Riverwalk called Casa Rio. And as soon as I walked in, there was this little plaque that said, you know, we respectfully ask that you keep all your handguns concealed as per restaurant policy. I'm like, yep, I'm in Texas. Was there anything like that for you guys?
Well, on my walk to one of the hotels that we had our sessions at, there's a restaurant that you walk by with a guy out front, really booming voice, mm-hmm. and he had two guns on his hips, trying to entice people to come into the restaurant partake.
That apparently is supposed to get you to come in.
Yes, two guns on his hips.
And a dude yelling at you.
He was going into the streets, into the cars, and talking with people like as they're driving by, right?
They got to rethink that. Did you actually see people going into this restaurant?
Yeah, I did.
Oh,
yeah.
My goodness.
I was kind of intrigued.
apparently worked. For me, we went to a restaurant. All of us went to a restaurant called Big Bib Barbecue House or something like that. And first of all, any restaurant called Big Bib, that alone struck me as Texan. But the one that really struck me, and I just had a moment where I just paused and just kind of took it in, was when I ordered, which was kind of amusing. So I'm ordering my barbecue, and she goes, "Do you want a drink?" And so first thing I get is this cup given to me that is no longer a cup. There's this point at which you actually transition from a cup to a bucket. And so she hands me this bucket. And I just sat there for a moment in ordering. I just paused and just stared at it, just kind of taking it in. Like, this is amazing. Like, I will not be able to drink all this. And then she's asking me, I ordered baby back ribs. And she goes, "Is that all you want? You know, do you want any brisket or anything else with that?" And I'm thinking to myself, if this is how big the cup is, like, clearly I don't want to add any more to it.
Now, there was free refills on that too.
Yeah, and there was free refills. Now, the part though that gets me is I get my food. And Terry, you'll appreciate this because I only got four baby back ribs. Like,
yeah.
Like, although you got a bucket for your drink, like, I was disappointed in the quantity
the
of meat.
The amount of meat.
Because you got actually three ribs.
Everybody had more than I did.
I remember you being a little bit upset about that.
I was choked, yeah.
But the best part was, apparently this is one of the top rated restaurants in San Antonio. And with my baby back ribs, they gave me two pieces of Wonder Bread.
Wonder Bread.
Because I remember she
was
asking.
It was very fresh, though.
It was fresh Wonder Bread. But I remember her asking, do you want bread with that? And I'm thinking cornbread, right, in my mind. Right. And I'm like, of course I want some bread with that. Anyway, I didn't know what to do with the Wonder Bread with the baby back ribs, but it was good meat.
Man, I think we drove like 25 miles to get there, right? This is supposed to be a top rated place.
In the middle of nowhere.
Yeah. In the middle of nowhere. And it was fantastic. Sessions are going on even right now. There are so many.
I think
sessions.
There's a little bit of a lull at the moment. Yeah. But this afternoon things are going to kick up again at ETS.
But there are so many sessions.
I've been loving it. First of all, I mean, some of the people that I've seen, mm-hmm. you know, here at ETS, you rub shoulders with a lot of great guys. William Lane Craig is here. Gary Habermas, I've seen. Alistair McGrath's mm-hmm. here. John Piper is here. Who's some other guys that you guys have encountered?
Greg Kokel, Lenny Esposito, if you guys know who that is. There's a ton of, like, if you're an apologetics junkie like we are,
The list is long.
Yeah, this is like, as my wife told me, this is like Hollywood for nerds. That's exactly what it felt like.
In fact, you and I were at the bookstore, which, by the way, all the books here, even Lagos, everything is 50% off.
Oh, fantastic.
And I remember we're looking through all the books.
Mennonite Haven.
Yeah, and at one point you look up to me and you're like, this is nerd heaven.
Yeah.
I've arrived in a nerd, because this is Steve's first time here.
Yeah.
And at ETS, and it is.
Mine too.
Oh yeah, Terry as well.
Yeah.
And it really is nerd heaven.
This is like I attained my nirvana right here.
Boy, when they handed me this book, this annual, you know, with all the sessions in it, just like, this is huge.
Yeah, you need to take into account the program is 108 pages.
Yeah.
Lots of sessions.
And now each day you got to work your way through all these different sessions, figure out which one you're going to choose and what you're going to go to. And one of the things that you find every year is some of the stuff. First of all, some of the sessions are unbelievably amazing. Mm-hmm. And some of them are through the roof, like academic, nerdy.
Yeah.
What are some of the ones that you guys have found that you thought were pretty amusing?
Well, Terry and I walked into this one session and got our intellectual butts thoroughly spanked.
And That's a good way to put it.
At what point? Oh, go ahead. What was the name of this?
The title is World Mariology in Thomistic Modal Realism.
At what point did you realize you've gone to the wrong session?
After about the first 10 words?
I hung in there for like 5 minutes, and then they started talking about. They started dropping names like Everett and these guys who talk about the multiverse. And right there, I was, okay, I am way – this is out of my league right here, because they're dropping names assuming that I know something about these guys, and I've never even heard of their names, let alone read any of their stuff. So I was like, I might have to leave a little early.
What are some of the other sessions, though, that you guys looked at that looked pretty amazing?
Oh, man. I mean, I took in a lot of different sessions. I mean, there was a C.S. Lewis session. There was Old Testament backgrounds in ancient Near East I took in. Took in some church history. But I don't know. One of the sessions that I really enjoyed was called Naturalism and the Mental Problem of Causal Drainage, Filling a Gap in the Argument from Reason.
Wow. Yeah. Some of these titles, man.
Yeah.
That was a good one.
That was a good one. I enjoyed that one. But there's
one of the ones that amused me was a session called Why We Must Sing Along, the Theological Case for Congregational Singing. Right. I didn't know that there was a theological case to be made for that, but apparently there is.
Apparently there is.
I missed that one.
You missed that one.
Yeah, I haven't gone to this session here, but this one, the title just got me. Socinian Hinduism. Raja Ram Mohan Roy, the Serampore Mission, and the Rise of Neo-Hinduism. Talk about esoteric right here.
Wow. Yeah. Now, the one that I did go to, though, that was fantastic, probably one of the best ones that I heard while I was here this week, Gary Habermas gave a session called Agnostic Historical Jesus Scholarship versus the Jesus Mythicist. And it was a fantastic discussion of where things are at. I mean, a lot of people don't realize this, but a lot of scholars that are non, you know, Christian scholars, such as Bart Ehrman, for example, who is agnostic, although I've been hearing lately that actually Habermas even talked about this, that he's claiming now to be an atheist. I don't know if that's the case or not, but that was interesting. But there's other guys now that, and another guy that was actually new to me that I wanted to share here, by the name of Maurice Casey. And he wrote a book. So on the same lines as like Bart Ehrman, who's writing against these mythicists. Yeah. And Ehrman wrote a book called Did Jesus Exist? Mm-hmm. Great, great book in which he takes them to task. There's this new guy, Maurice Casey, and he wrote Jesus, Evidence and Argument or Mythicist Myths. And apparently that was written in 2014. Apparently he is just nasty, I guess, as he goes after these mythicists. He's not, he doesn't mince his mince words, like really doesn't like these guys.
By the way, our listeners, you probably figured out just through the context who, like, what the point of Jesus mythicists are, but these are a group of people that basically claim that Jesus of Nazareth never even existed as a historical figure.
Now, so that's part of it.
Yeah.
And then the other part of it is, so A, they don't think that Jesus existed historically, but then the other part is that if you've ever seen the movie or that documentary on YouTube now on Netflix called Zeitgeist, it's, I believe it's a three-part series, but one of it, one of the parts is on religion.
The first one,
Yeah, the first one. So they're not just talking about Jesus not existing. They also are positing all these different myths along with it, you know, to from Horus, you know, to to what it, like we're talking extravagant stuff, to even stuff in the stars or whatnot to say
astrotheology, they call it. Yeah.
Yeah. So basically coming up with all these different myths as to why or how the Jesus myth came about. So not just that he didn't exist, but giving these mythical reasons as to why he came about.
Yeah, and Bart Ehrman, because he got so many skeptics emailing in asking for his opinion on this matter, he got so sick of it that he wrote that book, Did Jesus Exist?
Yeah, and part of it too was, I remember, and we've talked about this before, he was on a radio show with a guy, with this atheist who kept wanting to argue that Jesus didn't exist. And he got so frustrated with this that, because this was one of the things Habermas was bringing up, and is something that frustrates a lot of scholars, is you get a lot of what we'd call internet scholars, right? You get these 18, 19-year-olds living in their mother's basement writing their blogs that are arguing things that the scholars just think are ridiculous.
He mentioned one gentleman that called himself an expert.
Yes.
And he was like under 20 years old.
Yeah.
With no degree.
Yeah, that he was an expert in ancient literature and ancient languages.
Yeah.
You know, and he's 19 years old. And you're just like, come on. But here's the problem that's frustrating for scholars, and this is why we were talking about it, was, you know, what are you supposed to do about this? On the one hand, scholars don't even want to write on this stuff because it's so ridiculous. Like even responding to Zeitgeist, I mean, you just don't even want to do it because it doesn't even, it's so ridiculous, it doesn't even deserve a response.
Yeah, and if you give it the response, it, in a way you're kind of validating almost, or they'll take it that way, right?
Right.
You don't want to.
But then on the other hand, because of the internet age and people being able to publish stuff so easily, the society at large is so easily duped. This is one of the things, if you remember, guys, that I wrote an article on McLean's, because McLean's last year, it was at Easter time,
right,
put out a whole article on Jesus never existing, which they quoted Richard Carrier, who's one of two scholars in the world that will argue that Jesus never existed. And for a long time, he was the only one. There's just recently been another guy.
Yeah, and I think that it's really important to understand, too, though. Like, there are thousands of scholars of just all kinds of backgrounds, including atheists and agnostics. And these are the guys who are arguing, no matter, you know, never mind the resurrection, you know, no matter what they say about the resurrection or Jesus' deity, one thing they all agree on is, yep, Jesus existed as a historical figure. Yeah. And these are the guys that are fringe guys that are taking that extra step, saying, no, Jesus never existed, not even as a historical figure.
It was interesting because after Habermas's talk, after his lecture, Mary Jo Sharp was there, and she's written quite a bit on this.
Yeah, I remember.
And she just asked, you know, with scholarship just so against this mythicist idea, you know, should we even be responding to this anymore? And that was kind of getting back to what we were just talking about there. And then ultimately it's like, well, we have to, just for the general public, so that people don't get duped into these ridiculous ideas.
Right.
It might say something if we didn't respond.
And that was the other thing too. Right? It might say something if we didn't respond. It might give credit to these people and these wacky ideas. But this is one thing I love about ETS. We use ETS and EPS back and forth. But this is one of the things I love about this, is that you can have all these Christian thinkers, scholars coming together and talking about what's latest and greatest, and helping kind of make sure that everybody's on the same page as to what's going on, and to hear where new scholarship's going or where scholarship needs to go, addressing current issues in the church. I just want to give a shout out to anybody listening to our podcast that, you know, is at all interested in this, you really should think about coming out to ETS in the future. Mm-hmm. This ties in great with the main idea that we wanted to get at today, and that was Time Magazine just came out with their Word of the Year. Mm-hmm. They came out with this just a couple days ago. And the Word of the Year, I personally have never heard this used before. The Word of the Year is post-truth. But Steve, you said you've come across this with...
I've heard the phrase post-truth politics, and that's the only place that I actually really heard that.
Terry, have you ever come across this word?
I have not, no.
So I was kind of surprised that it made Word of the Year.
Apparently it's usage, but by the way, this was put out by Oxford Dictionaries. And so, and these guys, they actually track the actual usage of words, and I'm not sure exactly how they do it. There is a link there that you can check out, but they somehow managed to track word usage, and based on the actual usage, they said the word post-truth, although it first came out in the 1990s, like 92 or 95 or something like that, its actual usage just exploded in the last year by 2,000%.
Now, here's the definition of post-truth. Post-truth is relating to or denoting circumstances in which objective facts are less influential in shaping public opinion than appeals to emotion and personal belief.
I think the whole mythicist thing kind of falls into that category, don't you think?
It absolutely does. That's why I wanted to transition into it from there. Is because that's exactly what, in fact, this was one of Habermas's main points, is the emotion that a lot of these guys like Richard Carrier and others, and particularly those on the internet, mm-hmm. that are arguing for it. He just can't get over how emotionally charged these people are, mm-hmm. in making this case. He's like in scholarship, he goes, you know, I've never seen so many angry people in my life. Not to say that these people are scholars that are doing this, although Richard Carrier is. Mm-hmm. And you can't help but wonder, like, where is all this emotion coming from? And I personally think this is one thing that we've got to be careful of, right? Is that for these guys, you can't help but feel that the emotion is what's driving the argument. Because mm-hmm. what's interesting about that is it's not enough to say that Christianity is false, right? Or that God doesn't exist or something like that. It's that they want to argue that Jesus never even existed, mm-hmm. right? That's what they're seeking to do.
It's just think about it, right? If their argument is successful and they prove that Jesus never existed, that would cut out a whole lot of arguments. Right, they'll never have to talk about Jesus' deity, the resurrection, or anything like that. The world's largest religion, what it's founded on, mm-hmm. is just gone.
Well, and here's something else that they'll do that Habermas was picking up on, and absolutely right. And so one of the things then that they'll do is to avoid all of that is they'll say Jesus never existed, and then they'll seek to date all of anything to do with Jesus as late as possible or try to remove him entirely. Mm-hmm. So if Josephus talks about Jesus, they want to remove it or right. get rid of it. If Josephus even talks about James, the brother of Jesus, they either want to remove that or they come up with these bizarre ideas. You remember this, Terry? These bizarre ideas that Jesus stands for something completely different, perhaps a brotherhood of Jewish believers, and that's what's meant by James, the brother of Jesus, when Josephus refers to James. Just these outlandish ideas, right? Anything to do just to get rid of them. Now, the one that got me was wanting to date the Gospels as late as possible. Mm-hmm. So into the second century, you know, 180 AD kind of thing. So it's interesting where the funny part is with that is that we have fragments that date earlier than that.
Yeah. I'd be very curious to see how the mythicists date some of the other early writings, like, say, the infancy gospel of Thomas, all these, like, Gnostic gospels, right?
Well, that was one of the things Habermas talked about is that you'll read these guys when they talk about other religions, for example, such as Buddhism, where you've got documents that are 1,000 years later, right? And they'll be very friendly talking about Siddhartha and Buddhist literature. Mm. But then when it comes to Christianity, just venomous and arguing for these incredibly late dates and being very uncharitable.
Just reading part of this article here, I mean...
On Time Magazine?
Yeah. Social media has really played a big part in promoting this.
This idea of post-truth?
This post-truth. It's almost fueling it, right? Like, you can put anything on the internet and, you know, people will just eat it up. You know, somebody saying it that seems like a good source or whatever. I mean, you see it all over the place. Even Facebook, came out with... just this week about Facebook and all the mistruths on there before the election, you know, that kind of stuff. But, I mean, it seems like it's very fueled by the social media.
Yeah, there was I think it was Washington Post. I forget which one it was. Maybe New York Times. But one of them actually showed two separate feeds, like a group of news items that a Democrat supporter likely will see on Facebook as opposed to, say, a Republican supporter might see. And these are quite different because the algorithm is structured in such a way that you see what you're interested in already.
Yeah. Right? Which so really colors your view of how the world is.
And then all you need to do is just kind of throw in into the mix a little bit of like the bending of the truth or whatever, and off you go.
It says here that the post-truth as a concept has been finding its linguistic footing for some time, and social media is helping with this, right? Yeah.
I can't help but wonder, too, if the social justice warriors, as we've talked about before, if they have also lended, you know, support into this word, because so much of what we see today going on in the university is emotionally driven. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I was just reading an article about, there's a session that's coming up here at ETS, or actually to be really specific, for those of you who are curious, EPS is in a different state each year, or ETS. It follows the AAR, the American Academy of Religious Studies. Mm-hmm. And so we're actually staying for both of those this year. I'm going to be going to the Polanyi Society as well. And there's a paper that's being read there that's talking about how professors at these local universities are now afraid of students. Mm-hmm. And I thought how fascinating that is because, you know, because of how emotionally charged everything can be, this is no longer now about truth and about the professors talking about, you know, studies. They have to be so careful on treading that they don't upset people in what they're saying, that you kind of see this post-truth working itself out in the university right now.
And that's what happens with political correctness, right? And with political correctness, really what's happening is personal offense starts to have some kind of social currency and power and things like that. And so, I really can't say anything about people if I have even an inkling that this person might get offended, then I can't really say it. Or to make it worse, sometimes words are put in my mouth. You know, if this person wishes that I address them by this certain pronoun, then in Canada, things are moving very quickly in this way, right? The laws might get changed soon so that I am actually forced to say this, or I might face jail time. And so, I mean, the thing with political correctness is that it actually stifles truth being discussed openly.
It ultimately comes back to what we've talked about before, freedom of speech.
Right.
Yeah, now, because I didn't realize this before, and I'm realizing it more and more, how much debate and dialogue are essential to a free society and to the pursuit of truth. That you're allowed to bring up ideas, even ideas that might upset you, you know, and that you can argue and debate these ideas. But I mean, take even this mythicist idea going on. You know, what if, you know, as a culture, we came to a place where, you know, you can't argue against, you know, the mythicists that you know, Jesus didn't exist and that's the way it is, and it's politically incorrect to argue against that, you know. Now all of a sudden, scholarship just comes to this grinding halt, and these fallacious ideas are just allowed to run rampant. And why, based on what we're seeing in the university, is because with a lot of these ideas, oh, well, it upsets me, these ideas. You know, your ideas upset me, and so because they upset me, you shouldn't be able to have those ideas.
And you can see a lot of that with the post-election protests that are happening, right? And you see a lot of young people. In fact, KPTV just the other night released an article about, I think, about 108 rioters that were arrested in Oregon.
Yeah, in Portland, Oregon. I read this, Oregon. As well.
Right, and out of 108 of them, I think 31 or 32 of them actually voted.
Yeah, when I saw that, I think I just, like, mouth open, you know, just staring at the computer screen, just going, you've got to be kidding me.
And I think that just kind of highlighted just the raw emotions that are playing into this, right? That they would have this sort of, they would go so far as to burn cars and go looting and all that kind of stuff. And so where does truth come into all of this? It doesn't really matter. As long, there's something that they want, and they have to have it that way, right? And so when they don't get what they want, they'll show all kinds of erratic behavior. And I think that's really – I'm concerned by that, really.
I've noticed some pushback by some professors, actually, just within the last number of weeks. This one is, like, from September 28th. University of Toronto professor attacks political correctness. He says he refuses to use genderless pronouns.
Oh, that's Jordan Peterson.
Yeah.
We did a whole show on him a couple shows back. That, and I'm thankful for guys like him that are standing up.
But they're losing their jobs.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
You know, by the way, they're taking off.
Yeah. Know. And by the way, he's not even a Christian.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting enough, though, because at first people were asking, are you getting pushback from the university? And he's like, no, I'm not. Well, just recently, you know, he got a letter from the University of Toronto saying, you know, would you please stop talking about this? You know, it's just ridiculous. But one of the things one of the topics that came up even while we were here at ETS, Moeller was talking about, was that with the transgender movement, that there has been a movement away from science. And I think this is really interesting. I think this really speaks into the post-truth culture, that they've moved away from, you know, making a scientific case. And in many ways, the reason why is in case the science ever turns against them. They don't care what the science comes to. All they care about is the conclusion that they've reached. And so notice how that works then post-truth, right? It's about how you feel. It's about the conclusion you want to reach. And that's what the truth is. That's all that matters. And that ultimately anything else, you know, they don't even want it to come into play.
Mm-hmm. And I think one of the things that Albert Moeller said that kind of really stuck with me is the way he connected sort of this transgenderist activism with postmodernism, right? And that postmodernism actually is a necessary condition to something like transgenderist activism.
Well, it paved the way.
It paved the way, right? Yeah. And so with postmodernism, everything was about subjective experience and subjective interpretation rather than objective truth, because postmodernists, well, depending on the variety of postmodernists, you would say that objective truth either doesn't exist, or if it exists, you can't access it, so it all comes down to your subjective experience. When something like that is in place, then you can have a movement like the transgender community, mm-hmm. Actively pursuing to change the laws so that, and so that I thought was very eye-opening.
It was just a natural progression.
Yeah.
From idea to idea.
Because now it's not about the objective reality of mm-hmm. what you are or who you are. Now it is what I conceive myself to be, what I perceive myself to be. It is the way, so much so that there is a gentleman in the United States, I've mentioned him before, who became a trans woman, and then that was enough for him, right? He identified himself to be a dragon. For Pete's sake, he identifies himself as a mythical creature.
And this is the problem of a post-truth culture, is that if that's the case, I mean, once we get rid of these foundations that we've used to think and understand about the world, I mean, now all of a sudden you can just become whatever you want. Mm-hmm. The truth of the matter no longer applies. Now all that matters is how do you feel and what do you want to be, and then that's what you can do. And you can imagine then why you have people that are writing that, Trump became president, because emotionally that's what they don't want that to be true. Mm-hmm. Right? And so now all of a sudden reality is they're coming up against reality, the way things really are. And there is there's this impasse that we as a culture, and I think particularly us as Christians in the church, we're going to have to help navigate through this. Now, I know a lot of people think, a lot of adults maybe listening to this going, this isn't going to be that hard to navigate. I mean, this is clearly ridiculous. And I agree with you. The problem is your children that are growing up in this cultural milieu will get easily sucked into these ideas, and we're going to have to constantly help them to rethink through these ideas, mm-hmm. and to help them to think about these critically. I mean, one thing that I think that we often underestimate is how ideas in the academy work their way out in media, which our young people and ourselves, for that matter, are saturated in our, Netflix binge watching, if you will, that we don't realize how inundated we are with these ideas. And that we're going to have to become better thinkers and be more thoughtful on these, particularly as we're helping with the younger generation.
Well, we're out of time, so we'll wrap it up there. Thank you for joining us. The Apologetics Canada podcast has been a ministry of Apologetics Canada, and we'll come back next week from our own studio again, and we'll see you next week.